Very pleased to introduce Professor David Lalou, who is the director of the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Director, or may I call you David, or may I call you Professor?
I think David's probably fine.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for joining us on this series of the Global Philanthropic 20 interviews and thought leadership around philanthropy. Perhaps I'll start just asking you a little bit more about the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Because I'm finding out more and more, and it's surprising every time I hear more about this amazing institution. So tell us a bit more. You've got quite a few firsts, I believe, amongst your history, and you've got quite a history. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about your firsts and some of your history.
Yeah, absolutely. So Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine was the first school of tropical medicine in the world, and we're very proud of what we've achieved since we were established almost 125 years ago. We are an organisation that focuses really on research and education on disadvantaged populations, particularly across the world, and with a focus on Africa and Asia. And we're really interested in improving health outcomes in those populations by research and by education, but very much with a philosophy of doing this in partnerships with organisations, NGOs, universities and communities. In the areas that we aim to work in.
Obviously, stating the obvious, we've had a global pandemic to deal with, and blimey, I'm sure that's kept you pretty busy. So could you just talk through what that's meant for you and you as an institution and your work around the world? Because I think, you know, it's quite incredible what you've done, but share with us how that's been in terms of the last few years.
Yes, so I think like all organisations, so COVID was a real challenge for us. But I think we were fortunate in being able to be agile and small enough to respond very rapidly. To a certain extent, COVID has really emphasised how important the kind of work that we do is. I think for many of us, COVID for the first time illustrated how interconnected the world is, particularly in disease, and that what happens over there may be very relevant to UK or Western public health. And that was reinforced in a way that I think we've never seen before. It was a disease that really exposed the challenges and the frailties in our society, you know, both as we've seen here in the UK, but particularly in the areas where we work, particularly in Africa, where the lack of resilience to any insult means that something like COVID can really distort and destroy many years of work in advancing human health. And so I think we think through the impact of COVID itself sometimes and the awful tragedies of the deaths and illnesses that COVID has caused to many around the world. What we've not thought so much about is also the impact that had on the health systems, on the looking after mothers in childbirth, the control programs in malaria, all of the TB control programs, all of those disease systems or health systems that have been put in place to combat disease that were completely disruptive. We've seen, I think, even in well-resourced places like the UK, the impact, for example, on COVID on waiting lists. If you take that to less well-resourced health systems, that's doubled or tripled. And I think there were examples of this when we looked at the West Africa epidemic of Ebola, and many, for the first time, first of all, in the West, we realised that something happening in Africa could impact us. And that was the beginning, I think, of this discussion. Excess mortality in West Africa came not from Ebola, but from the complete disruption of the health system. And we've seen that magnified in COVID.
And we'll talk a little bit more about this, as you call it, resilient healthcare systems and what we need to do around that. And I think you touch on that in terms of the future. But I mean, it must have been quite a roller coaster the last few years, going from, you know, a superb organization, but perhaps lesser known, to an organization that's commenting across the world and actually taking a leading role in trying to help us sort out COVID. I mean, I assume that, you know, that journey has been quite an interesting one, but also a learning one for people to realise just how important institutions like yours are in the world and the work that you do that perhaps they weren't aware. And I know the community has really stepped up. I know the Liverpool community and wider community has given you huge support around the world. I really wanted to talk, because these talks are about philanthropy, and obviously the pandemic drove a lot of money, new money and new partnerships around philanthropy and changed people's perspective. But I do remember on our series of Talking Philanthropy, and the recording is actually on our YouTube, that Ronnie Chan talked about, actually a year before, 2018, talked at Talking Philanthropy about the worries that he had and his family had. And obviously the family had given $350 million to Harvard in public health. And this was very much around pandemics. And I vividly remember him as an answer to a question saying, you know, one of the things in the world that's probably coming down the chute is a pandemic. And it's something that as a family, we thought we would do something to try and actually help mankind, humankind actually be resilient and try and think about how we can get ahead of that. And then within 12 months, look where we were. So philanthropists, I think, have talked quite a bit about your area over a number of years. And I know you've been hugely supported by the Gates Foundation as well. But maybe you could talk through about the importance of philanthropy for the school and for the future. And you know, what does philanthropy mean to you, and what can it do for you in the future?
I think the key thing for a predominantly research organization, oriented organization like ours, is the freedom and flexibility philanthropy gives us to be more innovative, to look at more exciting projects, to take a longer term view of what we really want to achieve. We're highly successful in getting standard research grants from funders around the world. And that's, you know, that's our bread and butter. But if we're really going to realize the impact we want to have, then what we need is money that we can use much more flexibly, that we can really take through a 5 or 10 year horizon to make the greatest impact on human health. Philanthropy gives us that freedom in a way that the standard research grants, our bread and butter, just doesn't. And so it allows us to think big. It allows us to take risks, because quite frankly, in this arena, if you don't take risks, then you're not going to achieve the huge impact we want to do. And it allows to open up our horizons to really new ideas that I think can make a big difference. We are, by definition, by where we work, an organization that is comfortable with taking risks, because we believe very strongly that's the way that you're going to make the greatest impact. And I think philanthropy helps support that in a way that a much more conservative standard grant funding system doesn't.
Part of that is about being a mission, as I see it, and maybe this is, you'd have a view on this, but, you know, I think being a mission-driven institution, being very focused on what you do, presents real opportunity for philanthropists, because you kind of know what you're buying into and what you're supporting because of the focus and the mission. Do you think that's a fair comment?
It's definitely a fair comment. I think we're really lucky. You know, internally, it's very, very few organizations are as clearly focused on one thing: improving health in disadvantaged populations through partnerships. That's a very easy, it means that we have a group of staff who undertake all sorts of tasks, who really understand what we do. And it also means that it's very simple in many ways to explain to others. We're highly focused of all the higher education institutions within the UK. We are the most focused on a single area. And I think that makes it much easier to go out and to talk to people about it, what it is we do. That's a huge advantage.
I mean, that's, as an advisor to philanthropists, it seems to be a really important asset that you have. And so I think that's quite remarkable as an opportunity, a philanthropic opportunity. But I'm also, I have read, and I hope this is all, the press have reflected this accurately, but I read that the Sainsbury's family's first ever gift actually was many years ago on their journey to giving over $1 billion, actually was to LSTM. And I'm also very well aware that I think Bill Gates visited, and as many years ago, but it also has been very flattering about the work you've doing. And I think it's given enormous support through the foundation to you. So in many ways, you've got good company to build on in terms of some of the best philanthropists in the world actually recognizing that quite a while ago. So I think that's interesting. I mean, I suppose the question, if I were lucky enough to have a checkbook in my hand and to write you a $10 million or $20 million check, you know, what would you do with it at the moment, given the scale of the challenges to humankind? Where would you direct that money? Where would you put that money?
Well, we'd be delighted if you did have a check.
I don't, by the way, unfortunately, to hand, but someone might
stream you later on and see what you can provide. But I think I talked about this a little bit earlier, but a key thing for us is resilience. It's resilience to The vagaries of the environment, the vagaries of external affairs, such as the Ukraine crisis, such as the energy crisis, to pandemics, to new diseases. It's resilience to those kind of things that can affect a health system that quite frankly, in many parts of the world, is only just about coping. And we work in countries where the health system is functioning pretty well, but you disturb the environment slightly and it can't function any further. What we're really interested in is thinking through how you make those health systems more resilient so that they can cope with the insults that we will know will occur over the next 10, 20 years. And so our big concept at the moment is an institute for resilient health systems. Now, people hear about institutes and they immediately think about nice new shiny buildings. That's not what we're thinking about here. What we're using is the WHO building blocks to think through what it is we can do to help countries and regions improve their resilience. And that's around, there are many building blocks within WHO, but a lot of that is about individuals. It's about having the right number and the right quality of staff who can work in the health systems as researchers, who can really, are well equipped to help those systems respond to whatever the emerging challenges are. It's about improving research systems. For example, I think COVID is a really good example here. In the West, we were very used to getting regular updates on how many people were infected, and many of the decisions that were made, for example, in the UK, were based on modelling of those data. Many countries in the global south just didn't have those kind of data available. And so really we're not able to plan in the same way. And for example, our work in Malawi was instrumental in helping the Malawian government understand the kind of the number of cases that were occurring, where there were cases occurring, and then informing their public health plans. So data becomes really important within that. What we would like to do is support both very senior and new emerging researchers within the health system through the Institute of Resilient Health Systems, support activities, research activities, and pull those all together, working in partnership and using our expertise of many years of dealing with fragile health systems, to really try and make a difference in this, I think, really increasingly important area.
It sounds super exciting, that, David, and I hope there are philanthropists out there that will step up. I believe it's your 125th anniversary, so maybe that's a moment to celebrate, but also to for more people to hear about this opportunity, because I think resilient healthcare story is really, as I see it, not being the academic or fully understand it as you do, but as you described it, it seems to be the big philanthropic opportunity that is out there. Just in terms of a final thought, really, I know it's been described, I think, quite often in recent years that you're a kind of LSTM is a global brand that happens, which I'm a big supporter because I lived there for 7 years, to be located in Liverpool and a big fan of Liverpool. But you really are a global institution, and that means that you have a lot of activity in the global south. And I just wondered, there's quite a debate within philanthropy about the global south and the emergence, the need for more foundations in the global south and the emergence of philanthropy, which is quite exciting, and development of philanthropy in the global south. I just wondered, in terms of your operations and what opportunity you might present to a philanthropist in the global south, and maybe you could just have a few thoughts on that subject.
Yes, I think, I mean, clearly from our perspective, it's really exciting to see the emergence of philanthropy at scale in the global south. And I think for us, the real importance of this is that we can engage those individuals in what we're doing practically on the ground. You can come and see what we're doing, understand that, but also the understanding of the environment in which we work that is instinctive to somebody who has grown up in the global south. And those connections we can make between what the philanthropists understand and what we do And the context in which that occurs is I think, very important and different from maybe a philanthropist that's based in a Western or a more well-resourced country. So I think it is very much about the partnership element of this. And, you know, partnership goes through what a lot of what LSTM does. It's partnership, as I said earlier, with both academics, with NGOs, with communities, because that's the only way that you make, you really deliver the kind of results we want to do. And I think when you've got philanthropists sitting in the Global South who understand some of these issues instinctively, it makes that partnership even easier and ultimately better. And so for us, this is a very, very exciting development that we're seeing in the last 5 to 10 years.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, David. Presumably anyone out there that might have a checkbook handy should contact you and have a discussion on how to support you in your 125th and this emergence of the resilient healthcare story and how that might be supported. So I hope people that do watch that might be in the position do contact you, but I assume you're the person to talk to.
Yes, I mean, obviously be delighted to talk to anyone to tell them more about what we do. And also, you know, what is a really quite exciting 125th anniversary program, which is, it really encompasses not only scientific developments, but engagement with the local community, and also a great deal of culture. And so I'm delighted to talk to anyone who's out there.
I mean, certainly from my perspective, learning more about the work you do, I think it's just phenomenal. So congratulations to you and your team for what you did to everyone in terms of the response to COVID. And just seems now that you're so important as an institution going forward that, you know, this moment of reflection also, but building to make sure that we're even more resilient for the future seems absolutely critical. So thank you very much, David. That's a fascinating talk, and best wishes on your 125th to you and everyone at LSTM.
Thanks, Dean. Really, really fun to talk to you.